evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, here on WEBR Radio. It is Monday, It's the 28th of July, and we got a bunch of things to cover today, including the world of sports. Now, there's not that much happening in the world of sports, with the exception of a couple of little items worth mentioning, and then a little commentary on the Olympics. But before we do that, today's July 28th, and today is the day that Monica Lewinsky received her immunity from prosecution 10 years ago today, so that the Republicans could get to the bottom of the terrible, terrible scandal that was undermining the rule of law in this country. And you all know how that turned out. And in 1976, on this day, an earthquake in China killed 242,000 people. You know, we don't even mark these kinds of anniversaries. You know, when they happen in other countries, we aren't really very cognizant of them. And so 242,000, that's a lot of people. If we had a tragedy in this country that killed that many, holy cow, I hate to think what kinds of memories and memorials we would have for that. But China's a country of 1.6 billion now, so things happen on a big scale over there. Let me talk briefly about a couple of things in sports. What I really want to comment on here is that there, first of all, the Hall of Fame induction ceremony was yesterday in Cooperstown, and Goose Gossage was the only serious athlete inducted, the only one voted in. Five other guys were voted in by the Veterans Committee. Now, the Veterans Committee's been revamped, but in general, it's a mistake to let people in, too many people in, through the back door. As it is, the Hall of Fame's been devalued some. But congratulations to Goose Gossage. Also, the Tour de France ended yesterday, but you wouldn't know it from the coverage in this country, because although it was on a TV network, I looked it up just before I came in tonight, it was not on a TV network that I've ever heard of. And of course, because we didn't have either Lance Armstrong, who won seven in a row, or Floyd Landis, who won one and then had it taken away from him for doping, even though we didn't have an American, because we didn't have an American near the top, there was very little excitement, very little coverage in this country. And that's the way it is. But let's move on to a little bit of the Olympics, because we're coming up on the Olympics and it's starting to get a lot more coverage. I saw a cute ad on the TV today. I assume NBC's putting these on, but they don't take credit for them. Maybe China paid for them, but I doubt it. And it showed a pole vaulter pole vaulting over a wall purported to be the Great Wall of China to get into the country. A clever juxtaposition of symbols, but of course it wasn't the real Wall of China. It was just a thin wall. And of course the real Wall of China has a walkway around the top so that the tourists can go along it. As Richard Nixon said when he visited there, he turned to Mao and he said, "It is indeed a great wall." Brilliant, Nixon, brilliant. So the story that was in the Washington Post this weekend was about the problem over Olympic tickets. They had trouble with their online system, so they put a lot of these events, the last set of few sets of tickets, on sale in person. Of course, that's a heck of a way to run a sale. We don't do it that way anymore in this country. Everything is mail or Ticketmaster because of crowd problems. But they had 40,000 people there, and so they had police pushing back barriers. People were getting not crushed but discomforted. And when they broke the lines and rearranged them, a lot of people were upset because they waited a long, long time and they lost their place in line. So it turns out that China's no better at running this ticket stuff than we are in the United States. If you remember when the Olympics happened in Lake Placid, they had trouble with the bus system. Someone said they should have hired Disney to teach them how to do it, but they couldn't get people to the venues on time because, of course, you're up in the mountains on these two-lane, what used to be country roads in winter snows, and it's hard to get thousands of people moved around to these from one venue to another. And it turns out the air pollution is getting worse in China, not better. You know, China's been promising a lot of different things since they got the Olympics games awarded to them, oh, I don't know, it was 8 or 10 years ago or more. But they'll have all the buildings ready, and they will monopolize this, and they may have, they may win more gold medals than anyone. But their plans are not working out so far to control pollution. Basically, they were going to shut down, I think, about half the factories within the affected areas around Beijing. And they switched to driving every other day. Only half the cars can be on the road at one time. So it's going to be interesting to see if that does it, because the air in Beijing is so bad that it actually, they don't expect records to be set. For example, the marathon won't be a record because the smog is so bad. That's the what people expect. So we'll see how that works out. On a somewhat related story, there was an interesting item I didn't realize about Iran. It turns out that Iranian stars, they could be Olympic athletes, like they've got a champion weightlifter who may be the strongest man in the world, and they've got actresses and actresses in that, and they have been doing ads in Dubai and other places, and they get picked up on satellite back in Iran, and the powers that be are upset. So there's a ban on appearing in any ads anywhere in the world, apparently, for these stars of from Iran. The quote was that from the Culture and Islamic Guidance Ministry. I love that. These cultural and sports personalities are examples of honoring the Islamic Republic of Iran. They should promote the spirit of gallantry and not the culture of consumerism. Well, I don't disagree, although if you were to go to the Iranian capital, by all accounts, the culture of consumerism is all over the place. There's billboards promoting Western jeans, perfumes, cars, and then there'll be murals next to them hailing the martyrs from the Iran-Iraq war, okay? But David Beckham's appeared on these things. They had a big picture of George Clooney appearing in an ad for Omega watches. Now, what's interesting about this is, you know, Americans, there's some American stars that don't want to do commercials in the United States, so they do them overseas. Japan has a lot of people in ads who we never get to see in ads, and I forget some of the examples. Clooney might be one of them, but there's such a thing as a virgin in American advertising, and that is an actor or a star who is so big that they don't need the commercial offers, even though they're there. You know, most people, if their goal is to make it big in the media, and when you become a big enough star, people approach you and say, would you like to hawk our products? And they say, yes, I'd love to hawk your products for the money. They take the money, and they ride that media wave as long as they're famous. There's a few people that don't do that. Okay, I don't think Johnny Carson, for example, ever appeared in a TV commercial, except for promoting his own show. And there's some other stars, particularly old-time stars, who never did it. And those would be big gets if the advertising firms could get those people to do the ad for the first time, because they're a fresh face. Nobody's ever seen him endorse anything, so it means more. You know, Michael Jordan has endorsed, you know, probably 20, 30, 40 different products. When he endorses one more product, doesn't mean as much to people, is the feeling. But some of these folks, and I don't want to name names because I don't know who they are exactly, but I do know that some of them who've never appeared in the U.S. were willing to appear in ads in other countries like Japan, South Korea, other places, and take that money. And it's just interesting. So there's George Clooney appearing in an ad in Iran, of all places. But in part, it just shows you how westernized a lot of the people in Iran are. Anyway, I don't need to say any more about that. I just thought it was interesting. Before we move on to some technology issues, I want to talk about the death of Jimmy Chagra, and maybe Chagra. He was a a gambler and a drug kingpin who was implicated but not convicted of the murder of a federal judge in Texas in 1979. He died in cancer of cancer last week at the age of 63. And he was accused of being the mastermind of the hit on Judge John Wood. He was called Maximum John. And he was basically assassinated with a high-powered rifle outside his townhouse in San Antonio. And they couldn't convict this guy, but Chagra was facing trial before Judge Wood, and he was murdered just before the trial. He was acquitted on charges of murdering the judge, but he received 10 years for obstruction of justice and then another failed attempt to kill a federal prosecutor. So he spent a lot of his time in prison. But what was interesting to me about this story, and I guess I might have heard it once, but I did not know the connection to Woody Harrelson. So the convicted hitman, they did catch the hitman that fired the high-powered rifle that killed Judge Wood in 1979, and it was Charles Harrelson. He was a contract killer and a gambler, and he was Woody Harrelson's father. He died in federal prison last year in the middle of serving two life sentences for murder. And I just never put that together. If I ever heard that Woody Harrelson's father was a hitman and a murderer, I just never knew it. You know, I don't hold anything against Woody. I like Woody. I ran into Woody in a bar one night in Lexington, Kentucky. I didn't actually run into him. My friend Shiv did. He said, went over and said, I must meet him. And so Shiv goes over and introduces himself. I thought, you know, I'm going to leave poor Woody alone. Moving on to some technology. Actually, you know what we're going to do before we move on to technology? We're going to take a short break. This is the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, and I don't want to send you spam, but there are people out there who do.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to send you spam. You'll read about my scam, and please say to me, you'll give a tinker's damn. Now let me send you spam. I wanna send you spam, and when I send it, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my urge
to the Andy Finn Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS radio network.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's move on to technology tonight, because there's been some news in the tech world. One of the first items is that the FCC finally approved the merger of XM and Sirius Satellite Radio. Now, I have to tell you, when they first announced this, I was dead set against it. And I've kind of warmed up to the idea, although I'm not happy about it. So, XM and Sirius are the only two satellite companies out there. So the idea was you got to have competition in any given delivery system, and so they shouldn't be allowed to merge. In fact, when they started, they were given their licenses to broadcast with the proviso that they would not merge, that they would provide a competitive environment. And what happened was they mismanaged their businesses and then went to the FCC hat in hand, and basically it was like Major League Sports. They said, we can't control ourselves. We've given away too much money. Now we can't make a profit. Please, please save us from ourselves. What happened was XM and Sirius, which didn't have a business model to suggest they could make hundreds of millions of dollars, did the same thing that people did during the tech bubble. They said, we got to have a lot of bandwidth, you know, a lot of installed base of broadband if we're going to be a player in the internet marketplace in terms of long-haul content and all that stuff, carrying content in fiber optic cables and all that. So people built a lot more than they could afford or they needed or believed they could get return on. Well, XM and Sirius did the same thing. I think they offered Howard Stern something like, I don't know if it was a $500 million package or something, 300. I don't know how much. I don't remember how much it was. And along with a lot of other people. And the idea was they wanted better programming because they were, however many millions of subscribers to satellite radio there were out there, they wanted to corner, you know, if there's going to be 20 million eventually, they said, well, we got to get the vast majority of that. So XM and Sirius both overpaid for the talent they brought on board and tried to offer more services. Well, let me just back up and say something about competition and the way things work in the world of business. Every industry faces this same issue. You know, there are never more, we talk about competition, but there are never more than five major players in any mature industry. It always shakes out to be three to five major players and then some high-end and low-end players. Okay, high-end being boutique, specialty kinds of things, and low-end being budget, airline industry, auto industry. There's theories out there in business and economics that suggest it doesn't matter the industry, it always works that way. Well, in satellite, like other media, the limiting factor is the technology. We don't have enough bandwidth to have eight or nine satellite companies, so we can't see how it's going to shake out. So knowing there were only two, the government put these rules in place. But they should have seen this coming. You cannot pay one host $400-500 million over a period of, I don't know, 10-12 years for a 3-hour-a-day show and expect you're ever going to turn a profit in satellite radio. So anyway, that aside, as this case has gone on, and it's taken more than a year for them to decide this merger, they basically laid open their books pretty much, and it's what they're showing is that neither side can make any money at this, right? And so at one level, I'm okay with it, because in a way, the way technology works is you don't have to have competition necessarily in satellite. It would be nice. Now Sirius and XM will offer satellite radio at a certain price and try and entice as many people as possible. So they may lower prices at some point, but they're competing against other forms of delivery. If you're talking radio, we got free over-the-air delivery. Of course, that doesn't do you any good out in the middle of nowhere. There's now internet radio, which you can actually get in your car at times, not all the time. And then there's MP3 players and iPods, and a lot of people are downloading their content from internet radio or from the internet, putting it on their iPod, and then listening to it. Still not the same as being able to drive cross country And if you're a Rush Limbaugh fan, listen to all 3 hours of the Rush Limbaugh show without interruption. In general, you can go from city to city and get and do that with a very popular show like Limbaugh's show in the heartland. But you certainly can't, and with NPR you do it as well, but you certainly can't do it with a lot of content that people might want, and certainly not with the hundreds of channels you get on Sirius and XM. So, on one level, I'm opposed philosophically to this. I think they mismanaged their businesses, and this shouldn't be allowed. On another, I've resigned myself to it. You could see it coming for over a year, and it's not going to be the end of the world. If they price themselves too high, they'll lose subscribers. They have about 18 million now. If they price themselves too high, they won't gain subscribers. So I'm not happy with how it was set up, but that's the way it is. And let's see, one other technology issue. There's an interesting issue, editorial in this morning's Washington Post by Robert McDowell. And he's currently a commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission that handles all this kind of stuff. And this was about the Internet. And basically, he talked about the fact that, you know, the Internet's been pretty much self-governing since it began, and it's worked out pretty well. They've got several governing boards that have sprung up over the years. There's an engineering task force. There's an architecture board. There's ICANN, I-C-A-N-N, which oversees how URLs are dispersed and what extensions that we're going to have, like .com, .biz, .org. And there's the Internet Society. So business people, academics, engineers get involved in this. And it's not really dominated by companies and by companies' positions. It's really as it originally was, within limits, with a lot of commercial interests vying for input now, it is self-regulating. The government has not stepped in to regulate it. What McDowell is pointing out in this editorial today is that we've got a little bit of a crisis coming, and that is the peer-to-peer file-sharing systems that are out there. You know, originally it was Napster, but of course Napster got banned because they were grabbing content and putting it on their servers, letting people put it on their servers. Now, if you use a peer-to-peer, whether it's BitTorrent or you use LimeWire or some of these other peer-to-peer systems, and whether you want to download a movie, which is a big file, 2 hours of video, or songs, basically, chances are you're violating copyright law, but let's assume that you aren't. You're downloading someone's documentary or something. The problem is that that's a lot of bandwidth to pull from someone else's computer to your computer. And, as always, the bottlenecks in technology are not in the backbone network, they're in the local loop. So there's two components to almost all computer networks, but certainly to the old telephone system, which is essentially the backbone for the new internet system. And the backbone network refers to the network of high-speed, high-capacity fiber optics connections that run from switch to switch in the telephone world or from router to router in the data world. And all of that has tremendous capacity. And in the U.S., that network is so built up that at any given time, we're only using about 50-60% of the backbone network. We have spare capacity in the backbone network. The local loop is where the problem is. That's a term that comes from telephony. But what it means is that last mile from the central office telephone switch to your home, that's copper wire for the most part, although they're upgrading to fiber in some places in the country and eventually everywhere. Cable television companies have the same issues. The cell phone system is really a local loop or a last mile situation that plugs into the backbone network. And what McDowell was talking about in this editorial today was that these peer-to-peer network connections, people who download movies, you know, what they do is they say, oh, I'd like these three movies. And they hit on those three movies, the names of them, and they start downloading. Well, they don't care if it takes all day. And they may end up downloading, you know, 5 gigabytes of storage. It's a tremendous amount of bandwidth to pass through the system. But they don't get charged for it because we don't charge on the Internet by how much you download. So it's been estimated that at peak times when peer-to-peer networks are in use, or peer-to-peer services are in use, that 5% of the internet customers in the U.S. are using 90% of the available bandwidth because of how much peer-to-peer downloading is going on. And he just points out this is a problem and it's got to be addressed. Now, I don't know exactly how they'll address it, and I don't need to say any more about it here except to point out that we're coming to some kind of tiered service where you will pay for either how fast a speed you get, how fast a connection you get at any one time, or maybe how much total downloading or uploading you do. We will see. But these days, that is what passes for controversy on the internet. In any case, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the oil shock, the oil crisis, some people are calling it, the price of gas, and what's at the root of it.